Well, good morning, everyone. The next slogan that we're going to be looking at today says, examine the nature of the unborn awareness. So here we are looking at our own mind and looking to realize the nature of our own mind. So what I'd like to do in this session and tomorrow morning session, to begin the session, is to do a little bit of an investigation, to investigate the nature of our own mind. So this is a Vipassana practice, of course. And as with any Vipassana practice, when we're investigating the nature of reality, we are investigating that in our direct experience. And particularly here in this sort of practice of investigating the nature of our own mind, what we don't want to do is turn it into an intellectual exercise. Because I'm going to ask some questions for you to use as a basis of your investigation. And if you allow your intellectual mind to come in and go, oh, I know the answer to that one, I know, then of course we're not doing the practice. So leave your intellectual mind out and use your direct observation to try to determine the answer to the questions. Otherwise, we're not doing Vipassana practice. Otherwise, it's just an intellectual exercise. So just keep that in mind in this practice, and in also the practice we'll do tomorrow morning. So let's do a little practice to examine the nature of the unborn awareness. Okay. So finding a nice, comfortable posture. As always, we begin by preparing the body, setting it into a state of relaxation, stillness, and vigilance. In particular, softening and relaxing all the muscles in the face. All the muscles around the eyes, soft and relaxed. Allowing the breathing to flow naturally and effortlessly. Not trying to control or manipulate the breath in any way. and letting go of any hopes or fears, worries or concerns about the past or the future. Letting go of all of these things and simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Wherever you can most easily notice any sensations associated with the breathing. Now narrow your focus and focus on the sensations of the breath in the area of the abdomen. Focusing on the sensations of the rising and lowering of the abdomen as you breathe. And tie your mind with a rope of mindfulness to the sensations of the breath in the area of the abdomen. So of course we're using our mind to focus on the sensations of the breath in the area of the abdomen. But where is this mind located? So again, using your direct observation, see if you can find where the mind is located. Is the mind located inside the body? Is it located inside the head? Is the mind located at the place where the sensations of the breath are occurring? Is there anywhere where the mind is not located? Does the mind have a center? And if it has a center, where is the center? How big is the mind? Does the mind have a physical limit or boundary? And then release all appearances and simply allow the mind to come to rest. And simply rest in the experience of awareness itself. Resting in the stillness of awareness. Being aware of being aware. So let's start with a short review.
About the meditation looking for the mind, it feels very strange because who is looking for the mind? And I'm not trying to be intellectual here. It's like the mind is looking for itself.
Correct.
And it feels like it's everywhere because I can be everywhere I want with my mind. I can be in the past, in the future. And so it's very strange because how can you look for yourself? I mean, the mind is looking for itself. So.
But you can't, in a very simple level, you don't know where you are at the moment?
Yes, I know.
Well then?
But the mind is everywhere. Not my body. I know that my body is here.
Good.
Okay.
Good.
But the mind can go everywhere, and
good.
That's where I found it all the time. You
mean. Good. Very good. Is that how we relate to our mind experientially, that it's everywhere? In our behavior?
Oh, no.
Yeah. Ooh. So maybe our behavior is out of sync with what we've discovered. I mean, this is the whole point of Vipassana practice, is to come to realize the nature of reality. And the Buddhist assertion is that now we don't see reality in a correct way. So this is one way of approaching that. So we keep investigating, we keep looking from our direct experience. And for these Vipassana practices to really be effective, we need a very stable, clear mind. Because like in any scientific investigation, if a scientist has some equipment that they're using to investigate something, the equipment should be working well. Otherwise, whatever it comes up with, we don't know. It's unreliable because the equipment's not functioning very well. So of course we're using our mind to observe, but if our mind is not functioning well, meaning we're caught up in distraction and dullness and that, then maybe what we see is not so reliable because our equipment of the mind is not functioning well. So therefore, if we want our investigation to be reliable and effective, like a scientist, we need functioning equipment. And that functioning equipment is shamatha. With shamatha, we have a very calm, very clear, very focused mind, a sharp tool to use to do this investigation. If we don't have that, it can be a bit unreliable because we're sort of distracted, dull. The intellectual mind comes in and goes, blah, 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 blah. It's the answer is this. And of course, then that'll confuse the what we discover. So therefore, if we can really work on the shamatha practice, then the mind can be an effective tool to do this investigation, and we keep investigating. Very good.
So when you say don't investigate with your intellectual mind, so is it the first impression or feeling I have when you ask a question, where's the mind? And then it's like here, everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like that I sit there and try to get the answer. It's like what comes to me.
What comes to you in your direct experience. Because, see, we all have certain belief systems. And of course, many people in our modern society believe, for one reason or another, just because someone told them, that the mind is the brain. And so when you say, where's the mind located? The intellectual mind goes, I know, it's the brain. There, it's there. I mean, then it's not Vipassana practice. Then we're just using our belief system to answer the question, which may be not very accurate. Our belief system is just based on what other people tell us, not what we discover directly. So therefore, we need to get the intellectual mind out of the way, because if a scientist is running an experiment and someone tells them the answer, then they'll go, oh, I know the answer. I don't need to run the experiment. I know the answer. They told me. That's the answer.
Yeah.
And that may or may not be true. So we need to, in our own direct observation, we need to look. So where is the mind located? Then in our direct experience, we look. Is it really here? Is it here? Is it there? Where is it?
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Okay. So just to recap a few things what we've covered so far in this text. So So in this 7-point mind training text we're following, the first of the 7 points was the preliminary practices. And so we saw there that if we want to practice the main practices of wisdom and compassion, then we need to have a good foundation. We need to be really working on those preliminary practices and integrate them into our practice. And we saw there the 4 main preliminary practices were reflecting on precious human life and death, reflecting on karma to establish an ethical basis for our practice, and then reflecting on the unsatisfactory nature of samsara to really understand that there's no genuine happiness to be found out there, and also that the source of suffering is within our own mind. It's our mental afflictions. And thereby develop the aspiration to be liberated from suffering by looking in ourselves. So these were the core preliminary practices that are an effective basis for the main practice. And here the main practice, of course, is, as with all Buddhist traditions, the 2 main areas of practice are wisdom and compassion. And here, of course, mind training, or Lojong, is within the Mahayana vehicle. Mahayana vehicle, of course, is the vehicle to enable us to achieve the goal of enlightenment. So there, the 2 wings of wisdom and compassion here are referred to as the 2 bodhicittas. Conventional bodhicitta is the compassion wing. It's the compassionate aspiration for enlightenment for the welfare of others. And then the wisdom wing, the vipassana wing, is this wisdom of emptiness, coming to realize emptiness. That's ultimate bodhicitta. So these are the 2 main practices that we are to engage in. And what we saw, and we're looking at the ultimate bodhicitta practice first, the wisdom side of the practice, the vipassana practice. And what we saw there was that in the meditation part of that practice, of course, we need to prepare ourselves well, as we do with any meditation. And then also as part of that preparation, to have an effective basis for the vipassana practice, we need shamatha. We need a very stable and clear mind. So we spend a bit of time talking about shamatha. Because shamatha, this very stable, clear mind, is the basis for all other analytical meditations. It's the basis for all the vipassana practices. It's the basis for bodhicitta practice, tonglen practice, whatever practice we do. Because if we don't have a calm, clear, focused mind, none of the other practices are going to be very effective, because we're going to be constantly distracted and dull and so forth. So then on the basis of the shamatha, we can effectively engage in both of these wings of wisdom and compassion. And so we're looking at the wisdom practice first, and we're looking at a couple of slogans there. We've looked at the first slogan, which says to train to view all phenomena as dream-like. Sorry, page 3. On the right. Train to view all phenomena as dream-like. So we saw that even though everything appears to exist independent of us, there appears to be an independent me here, independent world there, if we investigate these appearances, we'll come to see that they're dream-like. What does it mean for them to be dream-like? A dream is something that does not exist as it appears. Because in the dream world appears to be a real, independent, material world. But when we become lucid in the dream, we'll realize that this dream appearance is deceiving us. So a dream is something that does not exist as it appears to us. So likewise here, it's saying that our waking world is dream-like. Meaning if we investigate our waking world, we'll come to realize that it's not existing as it appears. It appears to exist independent of us, but if we investigate very closely, we'll come to see that it does not exist independently, that the world is a dependent world, not an independent world. And we saw there yesterday that what does it mean for things to be dependent? is that they depend on their existence on causes and conditions, parts and labelling. And we saw there that when we say that things are merely labelled, we understand that we bring things into existence by drawing a line around a certain collection of data, creating an object, and then giving it a name. So things only exist within our conceptual framework. That there's no object to be found in the basis. We use that example of the star. That there's no star to be found in the basis. We create the star by drawing a line around all of that data and creating one object, a star. Or we could create two objects, two triangles, and so on. So things only exist within our conceptual framework, meaning they're merely labelled. They're not findable. They're not findable in the basis. Or in here in the text, they refer to them as mere appearances. So when something's a mere appearance, is the same idea, that it does not exist from its own side. It's an appearance, it's a mere appearance, and only exists within our conceptual framework. And then yesterday we looked at why is it a problem to see the world as existing independent of us? What's the big problem with seeing the world as made up of many separate discrete things existing there already? And for that we looked at this chart. That it's our grasping onto an independent me, independent world, that actually is the root of all of our suffering. It's the root of samsara. It's the reason we are stuck in this cycle of existence called samsara. So I'd just like to briefly go through this again, just so we have it fresh in our mind. Because what we said was that if we really want to overcome this state we're in now of dukkha, this cycling life after life called samsara, if we want to overcome that and achieve liberation from suffering, we need to eliminate the underlying cause, which is this ignorance, this fundamental ignorance, grasping onto independent me, independent world. So that's the long-term strategy to overcome this ignorance. But that could take some time. So what I'd like to look at now in this session is looking at an effective short-term strategy of how we can interrupt this process or at least reduce the impact of this process so that we don't have as much suffering. But before we do that, let's just go through the steps again so we got them clear in our mind, we understand them. So, of course, at step one, we talk about seed of ignorance. And again, here, ignorance is simply another... This is talking about our fundamental ignorance, this misunderstanding of nature of reality. So here, ignorance is simply not a not-knowing reality, but it's an active misunderstanding of reality. And it's a grasping onto independent me, independent world. It's grasping onto the fact that everything exists independently. And the seed, of course, is just the habit of doing that. And then when we look out on the world, everything appears to exist independent of us. And that's called mistaken dualistic appearance. There appears to be subject-object duality. Me here, world there. And of course, the world has only appeared to us in this way. It's never appeared to us in any other way. And we have the habit of believing these appearances, so we never question these appearances. There's no reason to question these appearances. We just automatically accept these appearances. There is an independent world there. And so we end up at step two. We're just grasping onto independent me, independent world. And then in every one of our experiences, we have this mental factor of feeling. And here feeling is simply experiencing things as either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And as we saw yesterday, let's say we're looking at these flowers and we're having a pleasant feeling, pleasant experience. That, together with the belief that those flowers exist independent of me, will naturally lead me to the third step, to assume that there must be some attractive quality there that's causing my pleasant feeling. So we'll see them as inherently attractive. Or if we're having an unpleasant experience, naturally assume there must be some unattractive quality there causing my unpleasant feeling, inherently unattractive. Or if it's a neutral experience, to see them as inherently neutral. So once we get to this third step, this misconception, then the fourth step easily follows. Because again, if I'm having a pleasant feeling, experience when I see these flowers, I like pleasant experiences, I want pleasant experiences. Those flowers seem to be causing my pleasant experience. I want those flowers, which is attachment. Or if I'm having an unpleasant experience, of course I don't like them, I don't want them. Those flowers seem to be causing that. Get them out of here. Aversion. Or if we're having a neutral experience, we're just simply reinforcing our false belief that these flowers exist independent of us. And that's the word confusion here, which is the same meaning as ignorance. And so these are the three core mental afflictions. All other mental afflictions come out of those, one of those or a combination. This is what's driving our behavior. And every action we do, motivated by mental affliction, has a consequence, has a result. And the results of our actions are our experiences. And the Buddha used the word dukkha to describe collectively all of our experiences. So this is how we are stuck in this state of dukkha based on our fundamental ignorance. And we saw there yesterday that in order to overcome this, we need to get rid of ignorance. So this is what's called the afflictive obscurations, is this fundamental ignorance. If we can eliminate that, we eliminate all of these, we can become liberated from samsara, we can achieve the goal of nirvana. But then also, we have these stains of ignorance, that also ignorance stains our mind, a side effect of ignorance. And these stains mean that when we come into contact with an object, we have this mistaken dualistic appearance. So that's why things, in fact, appear to exist independent of us, is because of these stains of ignorance. So to achieve enlightenment, to go on to achieve enlightenment, we need to eliminate these stains from our mind. Very difficult to get rid of. They're the last thing we can get rid of, even after achieving nirvana. And if we can get rid of those, we can achieve enlightenment. So these stains and this mistaken appearance they produce are called the cognitive obscurations. So that's what's obscuring us from achieving enlightenment. So if we can get rid of those, then we can go on to achieve enlightenment. So this is the six-step process that we are sort of caught up in. Anything not clear about that? Otherwise, we'll look at short-term strategy now. Anything still not clear? Okay. So remember, the long-term strategy is if we want to overcome dukkha or suffering, we want to transcend samsara, we want to achieve liberation, nirvana, we have to eliminate ignorance. So to eliminate ignorance, of course, we need wisdom. So that's the Vipassana practice. So the Vipassana practice of coming to realize emptiness, that in fact nothing exists independently. If we can come to realize emptiness, then slowly we can wipe out all of this ignorance from our mind and thereby eliminate all the mental afflictions and imprints and the suffering that they produce. And we can achieve liberation, nirvana. And then if we continue to do our Vipassana practice together with the bodhicitta, we can slowly then even wipe out these stains, and then eventually we can achieve enlightenment. So that's the long-term strategy, through the Vipassana practice of emptiness. But that could take quite some time, maybe even many lives to do that. So, therefore, we want a short-term strategy what can we do now in a practical way to at least reduce the impact of this process? So that's what I'd like to look at now. What can we do right now to reduce the impact of this process? So let's say we're at step one. So we have a habit of believing that things exist independent of us, and we see something and it appears to exist independent of us. Can we do something at step one to avoid going to step two? Anything? Right now. Can we do anything right now to stop going to step two?
Mindfulness.
How?
Being aware that what you're seeing is not what is real.
Correct. So this is what's going to actually come up if we just briefly jump ahead onto page 4. On the left side, down the bottom, slogan 6 there says, in the intervals, be a conjurer of illusions. So be a conjurer of illusions is the practice we do, the Vipassana practice in daily life. And that's sometimes called illusory-like emptiness practice. And that is to, as we just said here, is to not accept appearances on face value, is to investigate appearances and to come to see or to realize that things are not existing as they appear. But of course, to be able to do that, we need two things. One, of course, we need mindfulness. In fact, that's the common thread here. In all of these stages, if we want an effective short-term strategy, the common element that is required in all of these stages is mindfulness. If we don't have mindfulness, then what's going to happen is we're just going to react based on habit. Some stimulus comes, we react automatically. Then we're stuck in this process. The only way we're going to be able to do something against that is if we have mindfulness. So again, here, another reason why the shamatha practice is so important. Because if we don't do shamatha practice, then our mindfulness will not be very well developed. And even though we want to implement some of these short-term strategies here, it's simply not going to happen. Because we're just going to have a stimulus, and before we know it, we've reacted too late. With mindfulness, we have an opportunity. We have a little window of opportunity from when we receive the stimulus until we've started to react. That window of opportunity may only be 1 or 2 seconds or half a second, but there's still a window of opportunity to do something there at each of these steps. But to be able to implement, we need mindfulness. Without it, it's not going to happen. So that's the first thing we need in all of these levels, mindfulness. And the second thing we need here at step one is we need to have some understanding, at least intellectual, of emptiness. We need to understand, at least intellectually, that actually things are not existing as they appear. Because if we don't have that, then there's nothing to do. Because we're going to believe that things are existing as they appear. So then there's nothing to do here. But if we have studied a little bit about emptiness and at least intellectually appreciated that actually things are not existing as they appear, and even better, if we have then meditated on that and have some little taste of emptiness, then we're going to be able to start to do something here with mindfulness. We'll be able to start, based on our understanding and experience of emptiness in meditation, we're really going to start to be able to question appearances. We're going to say, well, this really looks to exist independent of me, but based on my understanding and experience of emptiness meditation, I know things are not existing as they appear. And in that way, we can at least minimize or reduce this grasping onto it as independent. So that's going to be very helpful. But let's say we didn't manage to do that, and we're at step two. So now at step two, we've simply accepted appearances on face value. We're grasping onto independent me, independent world. And we're having some sort of experience, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Can we do something at step two to avoid going down to step three and four? Practical advice right now. Can we do anything? Any of you who've done Goenka Vipassana retreat must be able to tell me the answer immediately.
Equanimity.
No, because this is one of the key elements of practice in Theravada in general.
Impermanence?
To work at this level. Impermanence, but that's not the answer I'm looking for. Come on, Goenka people. What does Goenka G say? Just observe, just observe, just observe. That's the solution. And so this second point is one of the best points in the whole process to do something effectively right now. But again, there's no way we're going to be able to do anything here if we don't have mindfulness. Because we're going to have some pleasant experience, and before we know it, we've already reacted with attachment, aversion, too late. So with mindfulness, we can notice the pleasant experience arising or the unpleasant experience arising. And then what do? Just observe. Just observe the pleasant or unpleasant feeling or sensation. And here, feeling can be mental or physical. We can do it both levels. We can either observe pleasant feelings, unpleasant feelings arising in the mind, or we can observe pleasant sensations or unpleasant sensations in the body arising. And just observe. And if we can just observe these pleasant, unpleasant feeling sensations, we can avoid going down to step three and four. So this is a very practical point where we can break the cycle. But let's say we did manage to do that, and now we're down at step three. So now we're already, and based particularly here on our pleasant and unpleasant experiences, we're already seeing things as very attractive and very unattractive from their own side. Can we do something here to avoid then developing attachment or aversion to the pleasant and unpleasant things? Can we do anything here to not go to step four? Any ideas?
Learning the first truth.
The first truth. How would that help?
Impermanence.
I think impermanence works better here. What can work here?
That's equanimity, maybe.
Wisdom.
Wisdom. What sort of wisdom?
Knowledge that we shouldn't be attached to something.
Shouldn't be attached.
That we see this beauty is in the eye of the beholder.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. So when we are seeing things and they really are appearing very attractive or very unattractive from their own side, then immediately we can go, where is the attractiveness in that object? Where is the unattractiveness in the object? We can search for it. You know, where is the attractiveness in those flowers? Is it that little pink bit? Is it the shape that's attractive? What is attractive? You can dissect and look for the attractiveness that seems to be there, or the unattractiveness seems to be there. And if we do this well, then we will come to see that there's no attractiveness or unattractiveness there from its own side. It's something that we have labeled based on our own experience. And then that will be very helpful to avoid going to step four. But let's say we did manage to do that, and we're at step four. So now some attachment and aversion is arising based on our pleasant and unpleasant experience. What can we do at step four to avoid going to step five, which is then reacting or acting on that, on the basis of the mental affliction?
saying before, impermanence. Yeah.
Yeah. One thing that can be very helpful here is to see that the object that we have attachment or aversion to is changing moment by moment. And that's also, of course, useful right back at the beginning as well. But if we can really see that that object that I have now starting to have some attachment or aversion to, if we can really see that as changing moment by moment, then there's nothing for attachment or aversion to grab hold of or push against. So generally, what you find is that the sort of antidote to attachment is impermanence. It's often listed as impermanence. To really realize, see that things are changing moment by moment. Because if we can see that things are just flowing, then attachment's got nothing to grab hold of. And likewise, aversion's got nothing to push against. So that's one thing. What else can we do at step four? I think that's more what we looked at here, step three, that the beauty's in the eye of the beholder. But let's say attachment or aversion is starting to arise. What can we do? Just observe, just observe, just observe. So the same technique as back here is that if you notice any mental affliction arising, again, this is only going to work if we have mindfulness. If you don't have mindfulness, it's not going to work. Is just observe that. Again, generally, any mental affliction has a period of time where it's growing. Even very strong anger doesn't go from nothing to strong anger immediately. It may only be a half a second or a second, but in that time, there is maybe some tensing in the body, some agitation building. And if we can notice that, if we can notice the beginnings of a mental affliction are coming up before they've got too big and they're already overwhelming us, because if anger or craving has got to a level that's already overwhelming us, then there's no mindfulness, we're out of control. About the only thing we can do then is run away from the object. Otherwise, we're just going to react. I mean, that's really the last resort. But we want to be able to not get to that point. And with mindfulness, we can. We can just notice some craving, some aversion, some irritation starting to come up, and then we just observe. Because if we then observe that agitation or craving or whatever as it's coming up, what we're doing, one thing we're doing, of course, is we're no longer focusing on the thing that's causing the craving or the aversion. So there's nothing feeding it anymore. So by simply observing it, it can't go anywhere. It can't do anything. It will pass because there's nothing feeding it, because we're not focusing on the thing that caused the craving or the aversion to begin with. Now we've shifted our focus to the craving or the aversion itself, and we're just looking at it. It can't go anywhere.
We can call it also acceptance. It, like we accept the fact, something we like or we don't like, and we accept the feeling that it creates in us, and we accept it.
We have to.
If we don't accept, we cannot observe.
Sure, exactly.
Equanimity.
Yes, acceptance, but we have to be very careful when we hear acceptance, because often people completely misunderstand the idea of acceptance. Often people feel acceptance means resignation. Whatever comes, just accept it. That's not the meaning of acceptance, because then we go, everything's okay, you know, accept everything. There's no wisdom there. We need to evaluate every situation. So acceptance doesn't mean just allow everything to happen. What acceptance means, the real meaning of acceptance means, in the present moment, this is occurring. I can either accept that fact or I can react against it. So acceptance means non-reaction. Don't react. It does not mean don't evaluate. It does not mean don't respond. That's what often people feel, acceptance. They just sit there, oh, just accept everything. You know, if someone's doing something harmful to them, just accept that because that's what I've got to do. I've just got to accept it. This is not acceptance. This is delusion. Acceptance just means don't react. With acceptance, we need to evaluate and respond with acceptance. So here...
And when you just observe...
And so when you just observe, then your acceptance, because acceptance, usually often if something comes, and it's unpleasant, we react, we have aversion. That's not acceptance, that's aversion. So acceptance is simply acknowledging in the present moment, this is happening. And then on that basis, we observe. And on that basis, then we evaluate. And then we respond, if we need to respond. So acceptance is not resignation. It doesn't mean sit there and allow everything to happen and don't do anything. That's not healthy. So we can be sitting there with acceptance, meaning acknowledging, okay, there's some attachment or aversion arising in me. But that doesn't mean, acceptance doesn't mean, oh, attachment's arising, that's okay, I'll just let attachment do its thing. That's okay. That's not acceptance. Acceptance means don't react. Acknowledge, but then respond and don't react.
But what is the difference, respond and react?
React means we're getting caught up in mental afflictions. React means attachment arises and attachment reacts, or something unpleasant happens and aversion reacts. To respond means to, if this starts to come up, is to observe them arise and pass, and then we respond with wisdom and compassion. So reaction is with mental afflictions. Responding is with wisdom and compassion. So again, we can only do this if we have mindfulness. Otherwise, we're just going to react with our mental afflictions. So if we have mindfulness and mental afflictions are arising, we observe them arise and pass, and then we respond as we need to, accordingly the situation. Using wisdom and compassion, we respond. You know, if someone's behaving badly, we don't just sit there and go, okay, I have to accept that and allow them to behave badly. Often what we do, of course, is we react with anger and we over-exaggerate our reaction and then it gets out of control. So rather is to note, just acknowledge, yes, there's a person behaving badly there, and then using wisdom and compassion, we respond in whatever way is appropriate. Restraining that person, maybe we need to restrain that person from doing that harmful behavior. But if we react with aversion, hatred, and anger, then it's out of control. And one thing that's important here is to not identify, and acceptance is also helpful for this, is to not identify ourselves with these mental afflictions. For example, let's say some aversion is arising to the point of anger is arising. Then often people identify with that anger and go, I am angry. And then, of course, basically we've given control over to anger. We've said, there you go, anger, you're the boss, away you go. And then we react. With mindfulness, then... if we don't have mindfulness, we will just simply identify with that mental affliction. We'll get caught up in it and we'll react. With mindfulness, we can see the mental affliction arising. Then the mental affliction is still an object. Anger is an object arising in our mind. It's not me. It's not, I'm not angry. I have anger arising in my mind. And then if we can watch anger as an object, and not identify with it, it can't go anywhere because there's nothing feeding it. It'll just pass. So therefore, not to identify with those mental afflictions. And again, to be able to begin to do that, we need mindfulness. Because we are not our mental afflictions. We have mental afflictions. But let's say we didn't manage to do this, and we've reacted, and now we're acting out on the basis of the mental afflictions. And every action we do based on a mental affliction has a result, a consequence. And here, of course, the Buddhist assertion is any negative, harmful action we do leads to a suffering experience. So let's say that we've, on the basis of a mental affliction, we've acted in a sort of a harmful way. We've done a harmful behavior. That has planted an imprint in our mind, which will later ripen for us as a suffering experience. So, of course, we don't want that to happen, but the imprint's there. So what can we do at step five to avoid that imprint ripening as a suffering experience at step six? What can we do at step five? Can we do anything to avoid experiencing the result of that behavior?
Stop
what? We've already done the action.
But during the action, like, you know, I'm trying to think about, like, analogy, you know, of me, I don't know, as a teacher or whatever, when I, like, lose it, you know, but I, like, get angry at something, you know, after I've been tired the whole day, whatever. So I can sometimes, you know, most of the time I can, like, quit. No, stop.
That's here.
Yeah, but I'm already during the action.
Yeah.
I'm doing it. So then I can stop. And then I could, like, take, you know, a few steps back, look at it, and then see how I can, you know, do something to fix it. Not to fix it, but to, like, make the situation become from A to B.
Sure. Good. Very good. And here I want to then look at, we've done the action, it's finished. What can we do now? What can we do to avoid experiencing the result? Exactly. This is in Buddhism called the purification, to purify our mind of these imprints and negative tendencies. And this is called the four opponent powers. So these are four things we can do, having done a harmful behavior, to purify the mind, to not go to step six, or at least to reduce the impact. And the first one mentioned here was regret. To have sincere regret for having done that harmful behavior. And so that's already weakening that imprint in our mind, and it's also weakening our tendency or habit to do that negative behavior if we develop sincere regret. Now here, of course, we need to distinguish between regret and guilt. If we've done something harmful and we feel guilty, what are we focusing on?
On the guilt, me.
Bad me. Bad me. So guilt comes from what's called cognitive fusion. Cognitive fusion here is, fusion means to make two things one. What we've done here is we have fused ourselves with our negative behavior. And we've turned it into bad me. Cognitive fusion is an invalid false perspective. Because here there are two things, not one. There are two things. There's the person and their behavior. They're not the same. When we do cognitive fusion and we go bad me, we've fused them together, made them one thing. And that's an invalid perspective. And if we do that cognitive fusion, then of course guilt easily comes. Because the thing we don't like is the behavior. But if we fuse it to the person, we end up not liking me, bad me. So not only do we often feel guilt, but we often end up with low self-esteem and even self-hatred. Because I'm just a bad person. I'm a horrible person. I'm a nasty person. So guilt, low self-esteem and self-hatred all come from cognitive fusion. They all come from an invalid perspective, a false perspective. So we never need to feel guilty about anything, because guilt not only is it coming from a wrong perspective, but it's completely useless. All it does is it paralyzes us and makes us feel bad. It doesn't even address the negative behavior that we engaged in. So we don't need to feel guilty about anything. But if we don't do the cognitive fusion, if we don't identify ourselves with our negative behavior and simply acknowledge, I have done this harmful behavior, then we can have regret. Because if we've done something harmful and we regret, what are we regretting? The negative behavior. So regret comes from a correct perspective, simply acknowledging, I have done this harmful behavior. So regret is helpful, guilt is completely useless, and it comes from a false perspective. And I think this is why we have such an epidemic of low self-esteem and even self-hatred in our modern society. Because in our modern society, not only are we always focusing on the negative, which is already unbalanced and biased, but we tend to focus on the negative with cognitive fusion, whether it's with respect to ourselves or others. If we've done harmful things, we do the cognitive fusion, we beat ourselves up, I'm a bad person, I'm a hopeless person, I'm a nasty person, I'm no good, blah, 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 blah. And if some other people are doing bad behavior, we also identify them with their behavior. Evil person, horrible person, nasty person, we need to kill them. They're evil, they're enemy, they're so forth. And so it's a big mess. So therefore, if we can avoid that cognitive fusion, then instead of attacking ourselves and attacking others who behave badly, which is completely useless, we can have compassion for ourselves, compassion for other people, and look at overcoming our negative behavior and try to help those who behave badly to overcome their negative behavior. So that's how we can respond instead of react. But if we do this cognitive fusion, I think there's no chance of developing compassion for people who behave badly, and probably no chance of developing even compassion for ourselves when we behave badly, because we're just going to beat ourselves up. We're just going to have self-hatred. Okay, so that's the first of the four opponent powers.
Could I say something on this cognitive fusion thing? A personal thing, because I did this course before, and sitting here I see how much I have forgotten, like almost everything. But this thought of cognitive fusion is the one thing which changed my life during those last 2 years, because I'm a teacher, and it changed completely my perspective on those little beings sitting in front of me, because I used this all the time when I was angry at one of them, like, he's coming late into class, and if he does this like 4 times, I think, oh, it's a bad student. But somehow this helped me to see them not as the action they are doing, but, well, they're little cute beings, but they're doing stupid things. And furthermore, it helped me, I had like 11 years old for the first time. And if you give a little 11-year-old a bad grade, they just crack down. But if you explain them, well, I try to, like, look, this is just an examination, it's not you, and your parents love you even if you got a bad grade. Because you're not the great, then this helps them so much. They still cry, but it ends.
Yeah.
So this is the one thing which I took from the last course. This time I will learn new stuff.
Good, very good. And that also reminds me, also, some years ago, when I was talking about this in relationship particularly to anger and that, one lady in the class, I think it was the introduction course I was doing here some years ago, she said, oh yeah, I do this with my little children, she said. She had two kids, I think 3 and 4 years old. And, you know, often if a child is getting angry or going into a tantrum, the mother will go, you're angry. And of course, then that's cognitive fusion, you know. Whereas she said, what she used to do when they started to get angry, she'd go, oh, look, there's that anger thing coming up in your mind again. And that forced the child to see anger as an object rather than I'm angry, you know. And she said it was very helpful for them to dissipate their anger because it forced them to see anger as an object, which it is, and not identify with it. So they're simply saying, oh, look, there's that anger thing coming up in your mind again. They go, oh, where, what? And she said it was very helpful. The second of four opponent powers is reliance. Actually, I want to mention one more thing on this. We were just talking about this cognitive fusion. Is if to really avoid it, we really need to start thinking in a different way, in the correct way, in fact, and speaking in a correct way. Because if someone's behaving badly, if we do cognitive fusion, and even if we have a good motivation of wishing to help them, through our language, if we say, like, you know, you're angry, and even if we have a good motivation to try and get them to overcome it, because you're directing it at them, they will feel threatened. They'll react if you use that language. You're angry. You're horrible, blah, blah, blah. Then, of course, they're going to react, even if we have a good motivation wanting to help them. But if we use language like, you know, do you realize this behavior is causing a lot of suffering? Then you can have the compassion towards the person and be very directed towards their behavior as the problem. And then they're more likely to, and particularly if we have a very good motivation, they often can sense that we care for them. And then they're more likely to listen. Oh, yeah, maybe that behavior, that thing I'm doing is really quite harmful. I better stop that. Whereas if you direct at them, you're angry, of course they're just going to react. Okay. Second of four opponent powers. Reliance. Sometimes translated as foundation.
Excuse me, what means reliance?
Yeah, that's what I'm going to explain. Reliance means that we rely on something in our life and we all are trying to follow some good direction in our life and we're relying on certain things to follow that direction. And so this reliance is like a sort of the platform that we're standing on.
Foundation
of our life. So our foundation may be simply I want to lead an ethical life. Maybe that's our foundation. Or maybe our foundation is I want to help others as much as I can. That's our platform. That's the basis on which we are following our life. That's what we're relying on. We're relying on being ethical. We're relying on maybe trying to help others as much as we can. So we all have this. But when we've done something harmful, we've sort of fallen down from the basis of our life. And so this second point is about picking ourselves back up and reaffirming our basis, the direction that we're following in our life. In Buddhism, particularly here in Mahayana, this takes on a very specific form. Because here, in Buddhism in general, what are we relying on in our life is we're relying on the three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. So that would be to, part of the reliance would be to reaffirm our refuge in Buddha Dharma Sangha. And also here in the Lojong, in the mind training, part of our, what we're relying on, what is our foundation, is bodhicitta. We want to achieve enlightenment for the welfare of others. So that's also part of our direction in life. So generally here in these four opponent powers, in the second one, if we're following Mahayana Buddhism, we tend to, this tends to be simply to reaffirm our reliance in Buddha Dharma Sangha and our re-establishing our motivation of wishing to achieve enlightenment for the welfare of others. There's two more steps, but it's time for a morning tea break. So let's take a break and come back at 10:45 and we'll continue the next two of the four opponent powers.